guys, what's up? Welcome to another edition of Everyone Has a Story. I am your host, Nate Wade, coming to you from the great state of Idaho. We have Olivia Michael on the show today. She comes from the What's Her Name podcast. She's one half of the hosts on that podcast. If you have not checked out her podcast, you are missing out. It is one of the best podcasts I've ever heard. It is fantastic. They present stories of women that you have either maybe never heard about or that the women that have been kind of forgotten about over the course of time. Unfortunately, that happens quite often. But if you're interested in fantastic, amazing women throughout history, whether they're aviators or Chinese emperors or all this kind of stuff, this is the best podcast to check out. You will not regret it. It's an indie podcast, but it is, it sounds like you're listening to NPR, quite honestly. I mean, it's just fantastic. Very high production quality, well worth your time to listen to. Well, not much has gone on this week. Just work, work, and more work. How about you? Has it been about the same for you? Did rent a movie last night, a movie I haven't seen. It's been one of those movies that kind of just got past my purview, didn't really know it actually existed, I guess, but started to hear about it more recently, especially because a third episode of John Wick came out this past summer, and so I decided to check it out. I liked it. Do you guys like it? Have you guys seen the movie? If so, shoot a text to me on Twitter and let me know, because I thought it was fun. I mean, it was cheesy, but I think it was self-aware enough to know that it was cheesy, you know what I mean? Very, very violent, but it was weird because it was violent. The death count was way through the roof, but it seemed like there wasn't a lot of blood per se. Do you know what I mean? But it was really, really violent. Some really cool, you know, action sequences and things like that, but Keanu Reeves may not be the best overall actor in the world, but man, he knows how to do an action role pretty darn well. So if you haven't seen it, I recommend it, with the caveat that it's very, very violent. If you have seen it, and I want to know what your opinion of it is, shoot me a text, let me know, because I want to know what you think. Have you seen It Chapter 2? I wanted to go see that this weekend, but the weekend got away from me. But if you have seen It Chapter 2, what did you think? Did you like the second part of it? Did it lose some of its appeal because it was about the adults and not necessarily the kids? Because, you know, I mean, that's how the book is, right? It's divided up into two sections. You've got the children section and the adult section of the book when they come back 28 years later or whatever, to confront this same monster that they thought they had killed. So was it any good? If you've seen it, let me know. Again, shoot me a text on Twitter at KNateRadio. That's KNATRADIO. I want some interaction. I feel lonely. Lonely on Twitter. Lonely on Facebook. Nobody interacts with my Facebook page or my Instagram. I'm whining again. I'll just stop. But I want to hear from you guys. And that also includes if you want to share your story with me here on Everyone Has a Story. We'll talk a little bit about that after we listen to Olivia's story that she was so nice to share with us here on this podcast. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Olivia Michael's story on Everyone Has a Story. Again, I know you basically, well, first of all, I saw your Twitter handle come through, What's Her Name podcast, and so I started listening to your podcast, thought it was great, so we'll talk about that a little later, but first of all, you're one half of that podcast, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's my sister, Katie Nelson, and I, and she is a history professor, and I teach English and Women's Studies.
Okay. Where do you teach at?
I teach at Naropa University in Boulder and the University of Denver Denver. And Denver. Katie teaches at Weber State University in Utah.
Okay. So she's the one that's closer to me when it's all said and done, geologically stating. Awesome. Cool. My wife and I just went on vacation down there. We stayed in a bed and breakfast in Longmont, I believe is it was called. And we actually went to Boulder for dinner and went down that little, like, I don't know, promenade or whatever you want to call it, they've got downtown there.
The Pearl Street.
Yeah, that was a pretty cool place. I've never been to Boulder, and it was kind of a fun experience. So
yeah, I really love Boulder. It's beautifully ridiculous and ridiculously beautiful.
There you go. So do you live in Boulder then?
I'm actually about a mile out of Boulder in a little town called Lafayette.
Oh, okay.
Which is right next door to Longmont, too.
Oh, okay, so. Gotcha. So there's all those little towns all right next to each other.
Yeah, we're directly east of Boulder. They call us Boulder Junior, which Boulder is perfect for us.
Okay, so does that mean you get as much traffic as Boulder does?
No, we're very small. It's kind of still maintained a little of its small town feel, which is what we like, but you're right next to Boulder, so you have all the good parts without all of the traffic.
There you go. That's fair enough. So did you, where are you guys from then? Did you grow up in Colorado or where'd you from?
No. So we moved around a lot when I was little, but by mid-elementary school, we moved to Utah. Mm-hmm. And so that's where Katie and I both grew up, and she still lives there. We've both lived literally all over the world and then landed back right here in the mountains. So I guess we decided we missed them.
Okay, that's fair. Why did you guys move around a lot when you were kids?
My dad was in grad school.
Oh, okay.
So we were in Illinois with him. And then for one beautiful 3-month period after I graduated from high school, we moved to Hawaii, which was lovely. And
oh, that would be nice.
Yeah, it was heaven.
Yeah. So how many? Yeah, I bet. Especially if you're, you know, if you're used to living in a colder climate like Utah.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
It was great.
So how many siblings do you have?
There are 6 of us. I'm the oldest.
Six. Okay.
And Katie is number 3. And then we have one younger sister. So there's 3 boys, 3 girls. And our younger sister is weirdly left out of the podcast. I never thought about that. But but we're a big family of enormous nerds. And
okay. Explain.
And academics, but mostly enormous nerds.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, fair enough. So explain, what do you mean by enormous nerds? I mean, there's so many different takes on nerd culture these days. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, first I should clarify that in my family with my children, our family motto is nerd is the new cool. So that's a positive for me.
That's perfect.
But our parents are music professors. All of us have gone into various academic and nerdy pursuits.
Oh, okay.
The first 3 of us are teach humanities in college, mm-hmm. Arts and humanities. My brother is a music professor in Hawaii. He went back to where we used to live.
Oh, wow.
He's no dummy.
Yeah, no, lucky him. Yeah, for sure.
And then the next 3 are all scientists. They do science and social science. So we've got this wide variety of very academic and nerdy pursuits that we're all very enthusiastic about. So I think that when we get together, we're very well trained on getting other people excited about the weird, obscure things that we're excited about. And we're all very willing to be excited about each other's things. You know, if my geologist brother comes in and says, look what I found, we all get very excited.
A rock. No.
Exactly. We're sharing linguistic trivia at the table, and what I learned about string theory today.
Like, that sounds like it'd be an interesting Thanksgiving conversation.
It we're famously interesting is a nice word, and I think people either love us or are driven crazy by us.
Yeah.
My sister-in-law somewhat famously came to the 4th of July barbecue at my house once with my husband and I, and everything was just going normal according to my point of view. And then about halfway through Katie's PowerPoint presentation on the history of the Ottoman Empire, my husband leaned across me to his sister, who is my good friend, and just said, "This is how the Hendersons do the 4th of July." And I just suddenly saw us from the outside, and we all started laughing and realized, oh, probably most people don't do this.
Yeah, I would say.
4th of July barbecue.
Yeah, no, that would definitely not be the norm, I would say, in most families. Yeah. So where you say your parents teach as well?
Yeah, they both teach at the same university that Katie is at, and actually her husband teaches there too. So you can get a liberal arts degree just from my family if you're at Weber State.
So they're all at Weber State. So yeah. I, of course, that's in Ogden, Utah, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and so my I actually had a son that almost went there because he is involved with he was involved with They call it indoor drumline. And Weber State is like one of the only colleges around here that actually has an indoor drumline, competitive indoor drumline.
Yeah, a phenomenal one.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And they were all very kind to the troop that was up here in Idaho. And so they treated him really well. And so my oldest son thought about going there, but he did not. But I still get to go down there quite often.
Well, we
because,
forgive him.
Yeah, well, okay, that's fair. Thank you.
My son is not there either. So.
Ah, okay. Well,
what are you going to do?
Right, exactly. We still get to go down there quite a bit because they do have tournaments and marching band tournaments in
right,
Weber State
yeah.
and also over there in Utah State as well, over there in Logan. But so yeah. We go down to Utah quite often. But anyway.
Well, big plug for the Weber State Music Department. They really are phenomenal.
No, it sounds like it. And everything I've ever heard, I mean, they sound like just a great music program down there. You're absolutely right. So, and you have relatives that are doing it. So that's why they're so awesome.
Exactly.
There you go. So you teach what again?
I teach women and gender studies and English.
Okay. So is that what you said when you graduated high school, that you were going to teach women and gender studies? Or I mean, how did you get interested in that kind of stuff? Tell me about your high school life. You know, what'd you do?
I was very much a theater kid.
Okay. All right.
All theater all the time. I was in about three shows at a time. Uh-huh. And I when I graduated high school, I wanted to be a theater teacher. I think because my parents are in the business, mm-hmm. I knew that being an actress was a terrible idea.
Okay.
Financially.
You're right.
And that it was a kind of forlorn hopes sort of thing. So I thought I was being very reasonable by saying, mm-hmm. well, I will teach theater. And I did theater. I was a theater major for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And then my very brilliant theater director at Weber State gave us the traditional, if there is any other thing that you can do and be happy, go do that thing lecture.
So he just wanted to prepare everybody that it's a wonderful and probably a fun major to be a part of, but you're probably not going to make it.
It's a terrible, difficult life.
Yeah.
And so I took that to heart. And, you know, my parents have sort of reinforced that too. Like, do what you love, but mm-hmm. make sure that you can eat. And and there are other ways to do what you love.
Right.
So I really thought about it. And that's when I switched to my second love, which was archaeology.
Oh.
And I was that weird kid who was obsessed with Egypt, which is not shocking when you hear how my family operates.
Yeah, that sounds perfectly normal, actually.
Yeah. So I was going to be an Egyptologist, and I did that for a year. And then I was finally convinced that my severe claustrophobia was going to be a problem for a profession that consists of climbing into tunnels and tombs and pyramids. So then I switched again to the thing that my mother had been telling me I should do since I was 14. She was right.
Funny thing about that, generally.
Major. Yeah, I think I would have landed on it much earlier if I wasn't just so determined that she wouldn't be right.
Right, but, right.
But I've always, I mean, I was also the kid that couldn't walk without a book in front of my face. You know, I was constantly reading. And so it was a very easy, it was an easy match. And I found my love there. Mm-hmm. Then I took my very first women's studies class in order to irritate my ex-fiancé.
Oh,
and that is a true story.
why was there irritation about that?
Oh, because he thought the whole thing was stupid. Feminists were stupid.
Okay.
The whole idea of women's studies. He was the classic, where's the men's studies program? Which, of course, now, as a professor, I can tell you is history, English, social studies, science. Everything else has been men's studies for about 200 years.
Yeah.
So I genuinely just signed up to make him mad, which is embarrassing and not a good reason to take a class.
No, probably not.
But about 2 minutes into the first class, well, no, all right, 20 minutes into the first class, I realized I love this. This is my jam. This is what mm-hmm. I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think if they had a major, I would have done that as a major, but it was a minor. So I majored in English and minored in women's studies. And the rest is history.
So, and you did all that at Weber State then?
Yes.
I guess that's kind of, I don't know, it seems kind of fascinating to me that they would actually offer those kind of programs to begin with at Weber State.
It was a phenomenal program.
Wow.
Like, I think I absolutely get, like, the idea that they don't do that in Utah, but
right.
it was it was fantastic. Uh-huh. And it was such a diverse program. And we were really encouraged to, because it was so small, we were encouraged to treat it like a grad program. I mean, when I got to grad school, I had already read a lot of mm-hmm. what we were doing in my undergrad. Mm-hmm. And there were so few of us that were really, you know, all in on the program that the classes were tiny. They were highly specialized. They sort of just built classes around what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So it was fantastic. And like, for example, the three of us that graduated together my year were me, the married 8 months pregnant student, mm-hmm. and a fashion design major, and what was she majoring in? Sociology, I think. But mm-hmm. also her night job was that she was a dominatrix.
Okay, that is so an interesting, eclectic group of people right there.
It was fantastic. And everybody was just so respectful and open to everybody's points of view and uh-huh. what we thought was interesting and what we thought about the world. And I learned more about how to think in that program mm-hmm. than in anything else. It was it was phenomenal.
Well, let's step back just a little bit. As far as high school was concerned, you said you always had your nose in books. What kind of books inspired you or that you just thoroughly fell in love with when you were in high school?
Everything.
Okay.
No, that's not true.
Almost podcast everything. Doesn't go on very well if you say something like that.
Almost everything.
Okay.
I started out completely obsessed with Astrid Lindgren, who most people know from Pippi Longstocking. And Pippi is wonderful. But her book, Rania the Robber's Daughter, completely changed my life. I read it when I was 8. And it just turned my whole world upside down. It was this amazing, they're Scandinavian books translated to English. And it's this girl who is the daughter of the robber chieftain who lives in this castle alone with all the robbers. And she runs around the enchanted forest fighting, you know, mean gnomes and taming horses and living in caves. And I mean, it was so exciting and so brilliantly written. And mm-hmm. I still adore it. I've read it so many times. It wears very well. And I think that was the first one that sort of gave me the idea that girls could do stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just loved it. And so I read everything she wrote and it's all wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then in junior high, I moved quickly into murder mysteries and I somehow just jumped right over the entire genre of kid murder mysteries. Kid mysteries. So I never read any of the Nancy Drew or any of those. I just skipped straight into Agatha Christie.
Oh, really?
And I devoured all the Agatha Christies in about a year.
In junior high school?
In junior high school, yeah.
Wow.
At about 14, probably. And I would, 13 and 14, I would walk down to the library, and it was 8 blocks away, mm-hmm. and check out my 10 books, which was the limit. Take them home, read them 3 days later, whatever, walk back to the library.
Wow.
Trade them in.
That's impressive.
So I just absolutely loved mysteries and I still do. I love sort of more cozy mysteries. I don't like the hard-boiled, violent. I don't like icky mysteries.
Icky mysteries. Okay.
I like friendly ones.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, kind of like you said, the genre of Agatha Christie and things like that.
Yeah. So, and I still adore those, but I also devoured fantasy and science fiction and mm-hmm. historical novels and nonfiction and everything ever written about Egypt. And if it was there, I was going to read it. Mm-hmm. My mom remembers me picking up The Scarlet Letter when I was about 9, just off the bookshelf because it was there and I was out of things to read.
That's a very deep book to read at 9 years old.
I came to her after a few pages and said, I don't understand what's going on. I remember thinking that it was a letter, like you would write a letter.
Right.
You know, that you mail and that they had pinned this letter to her dress. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And my mom wisely said, maybe wait a few years on that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of deep social and moral, the stuff going on in that book that perhaps a 9-year-old isn't even going to concretely understand. That's fascinating. So you just, like you said, you devoured everything, fiction, nonfiction, and all that kind of stuff throughout high school. And then it followed you into college. I'm assuming your love for reading.
Oh yeah. Still.
Yeah. So
3 or 4 books going at any time.
And did you read a lot of plays and things like that since you were interested in theater?
I never did in high school. And it never occurred to me. Well, I read Shakespeare. I read mm-hmm. Shakespeare obsessively.
Sure. Right.
But I never really thought about the fact that you could read plays, which seems silly, but it just wasn't something that occurred to me until I got to college. And in my theater major, you know, we had a theater play reading class, and I just adored that. And, and after that, I started reading all the plays. But until that point, I hadn't. It somehow weirdly hadn't occurred to me they could just read a play.
Yeah. I actually was a theater major my first year of college.
Hey.
And and it was kind of the same thing. I realized, you know what? I'm not going to make any money doing this. So I, I went and did something else, but, we had to write a play for one of my theater classes, and I hated it. I don't know why. It just drove me nuts. I wasn't very good. I got a C out of it, but I just was like,
writing plays is hard.
Oh, it is hard.
I mean, writing is hard. Here's me, the writer, yelling about this, but it's so much harder than people think it is. But writing plays is so hard.
Yeah.
I think people think it's shorter and it's going to be easier, and it's exponentially more difficult.
Well, it is, because, I mean, you know, when you're writing a novel or something like that, you can put all of your, building the scene within the context of the story, so it can kind of flow. But when you're writing a play, you have to think, somebody's going to watch this. And so how do you describe to, you know, whoever's putting on a play, this is what needs to happen within the scene? And it's just, it was frustrating. I didn't like it at all.
Right. And you don't want to have big, long, you know,
unless you're Shakespeare, then you can do that. Right. I don't know. So, you said you read a lot of these books as far as, women and gender studies in your undergraduate. What kind of books really stuck out that said, man, this is good stuff?
Bell Hooks is still one of my all time favorites. She's clear. She's concise. She speaks to everybody. Mm-hmm. And yet, you can understand it the first time you read it, and yet you can read it 40 times and find something new that you never understood before. Mm-hmm. So I adore her. Let's think. What did I read in undergrad? I'm going through my bookshelf in my head. Trinh Minh Ha was one of the first things I read that kind of blew my mind open. And she writes about post-colonialism and sort of the way that we have framed the entire world through the viewpoint of white Europeans and white Americans, and how that makes us wrong about almost everything when we're looking at the rest of the world. And it was one of those where, you know, you read half a page and just sit there and think, whoa, everything I know is wrong.
Yeah.
And, and so that one really stuck with me. And then I think for me, it always comes down to poets, Mary Oliver and Linda Hogan, and people who really I can't poem. I've tried really hard to write poetry, and I just can't. I am a distance writer, not a sprinter. And so I really admire people who can do poetry well. And so the people who manage to whittle down really expansive experiences and theories into just a few lines just amaze me. And those still amaze me. When I read good poetry, I'm filled with awe.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty amazing to do, for sure.
It feels like magic to me. I don't know how people
That's a good way to say it. It is kind of magic. Well, writing in general is magic. If you're writing a novel or even a nonfiction book, for that matter, to be able to communicate with somebody through words, it's a pretty amazing experience, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's both.
Yeah.
As a writing teacher and a writer, like, we act like it's something you can't learn. But you absolutely can. You can teach writing and you can learn to be an excellent writer. But it is also somehow like from the very core of the person. Mm-hmm. And there's just certain people who can access that in ways that other people can't. And certain writers that just, no matter what they're saying, like, I always say, if Barbara Kingsolver published her laundry list, I would buy that in hardcover because I know it's going to speak to me.
Sure.
And that feels like magic too, even though I know how to do it, even though I teach how to do it and I practice it every day, like finding the right combination of words. It really, I was just looking up some etymologies of words because I'm a huge nerd, as I mentioned. And I remembered that the word for glamour comes from the word grammar, and glamour originally meant like magic, right? The mysterious magic around things, that you can weave spells. And that comes from grammar, from words, because words were so magical and reading was a magic skill, you know. And and I still feel like that. I feel like words are magic, and we don't give enough credit to the power they have, but also the people who can use them well, I think, really are magicians.
Yeah. Well, and they've changed the world, you know, one way or the other, they've changed the world. I mean, if you want to look at a very, you know, I guess you could say popular example is Martin Luther King Jr. in the power of words that he used to change, you know, a whole society and how he looked at, you know, civil rights was through words and, you know, his peaceful actions, of course, but, you know, his speeches. Yeah. You always remember him, right? You remember the Gettysburg Address. I mean, nobody really remembers what the Battle of Gettysburg was about per se, but they remember that Gettysburg Address. And it was a short, you know, very pithy speech that was, you know, just a couple of minutes long, but everybody remembers it. It's incredible. So,
and I think, you know, song lyrics that shape people's lives in ways that shouldn't be possible. You know, how many of almost everyone I know has a moment of like that song changed my life, or it made me see the thing, or it, you know, it saved me from that emotion, or that words, especially in conjunction with music, but like they're magical.
They are for sure. So I have to, I want to kind of go back just a little bit here. And you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but what is your religious persuasion?
Ah, well, you might not want to put this in because it's long and complicated.
Okay. I had a feeling it was, but I needed to ask. You're from Utah. Everybody makes this, you know, so tell me what's going on.
Yeah. The TLDR is.
Okay.
I was raised Mormon. I am now, what I say is I am Mo-Piscopalian Universalist.
So, okay. I think I understand that just a little bit. So you're saying, so there's an Episcopalian part in there and then.
Yeah. So I mostly attend an Episcopalian
congregation.
I still very connected to Mormonism, my family, my children, my husband are still very, I'm trying not to use all the Utah words.
I would understand them. I'm not sure.
I know, but your people won't. Still mostly attend Mormon church, Mormon congregations. And, but we're field trippers. So we once a month take a field trip out to a new church. And I really love, I love religion. I'm I'm like a religion nerd too. I'm a religious junkie and I love experiencing all the different options. I love learning all the different worldviews and I just find it completely fascinating. I always have since a little kid. I love religious ritual. I love religious history. Mm-hmm. So I love doing all of it. Is the answer.
Okay. No, that's a good answer. I guess
going
I was curious.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fine. I was curious just because, you know, because of what you majored in and the topics of that, I'm just wondering how you reconcile that. If you had an LDS background, how you reconcile it, because it seems to me that the LDS church is a little bit, I don't know. I don't want to sound, they're hesitant.
It's not a extremely progressive feminist environment. You can definitely say that.
Yeah. And of course I'm in Idaho Falls, Idaho. You know, I'm smack dab in the middle of that. And you know, I see it on a daily basis. I am not LDS. But you know, I see it around me. And again, as you said, the church is a wonderful church. They're great people. Everybody's fantastic in it. It's not like, but as far as the way they look at things, they're not very progressive in that respect, I would say.
Yeah, definitely not. There's lots of room for improvement.
Well, and that's probably the case with most religions and most denominations, I would think.
Especially in the U.S.
Yeah, I would say and that's it. You know, that's the thing that I don't think we see or realize a lot of times is the Western idea of religion, especially in Christianity, is way backwards compared to the rest of the world.
Right.
And I go to a more of a, I guess you could say, a conservative Pentecostal church, if you will. It's called Foursquare is the name of it. And I'm actually very interested and have been thinking a lot about going to the Episcopalian church here in town because I've gotten to a point where I ask way too many questions. and I've, you know, I still have a really hardcore belief in God and blah, blah, blah. But I want to be in a place where it's not a bad thing to ask questions.
No, I mean, questions are the point to me,
right. Yeah.
I guess. And I know for many people, the point of religion is to get answers.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm weird, but for me, the point of religion is to find more questions.
Yeah.
I love finding new questions to ask and new ways to look at things. And, and as it is terrifying when something shakes your certainties and your worldview, but I also love it. The times when I'm forced to sort of take everything down and start over.
Yeah.
Love those moments in my life, as terrifying as they are, because that's when you get to find an entirely new way to look at things.
Yeah. And I honestly feel as if, you know, if there is a God, I don't think he's afraid of questions. Why would he be? You know what I mean? I don't know.
No.
Anyway.
I mean, so. God gave me this brain that asks lots of questions.
That's right. It's exactly right.
So
moving forward. So you met your husband in college, I'm assuming, because you said
in
you
high
were...
school, actually.
Oh, OK. But yeah, we were engaged with somebody else.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, my husband, Matthew, and I were just friends in high school. We were very good friends, and he was in theater. We were all part of a big sort of theater mob. Uh-huh. And then he went off on a mission for the LDS Church, and mm-hmm. I went to college and quickly got engaged, as is the Utah way, at 18 years old.
Yeah.
Oh, it makes me nauseous even thinking about it. I have an 18-year-old who is the same age that I was right now when I got engaged.
It makes
me physically ill. It was a terrible idea. I'm sure he's a very nice man.
Sure.
I haven't seen him in, 22 years.
Right.
But it was a terrible idea. And thankfully, it didn't go through. Uh-huh. But we were engaged for, 6 months, which for Utah is an eternity.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Before I broke it off and started to figure myself out, which was good. Mm-hmm. And then... when my current husband came home from his mission, we had always been really close friends. So we just started hanging out and pretty quickly realized, oh, hey, wait a minute. I think I like you.
And so how long was that from the time you called off the other engagement to when this happened?
Oh, a year and a half.
Okay. And you were married?
I mean, I got engaged like right first semester of college.
Really?
It was bananas.
Wow. And was he going to school then there too or what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. And so was your husband, did he go to Weber State or where'd he go?
No, he went to the U.
Okay.
And so we lived mm-hmm. halfway in between, which worked pretty well. Mm-hmm.
And the U, you mean the University of Utah or what?
Yeah, sorry. Okay. The University of Utah.
Sorry. Okay. Which I'm happy they won the game
Everyone
the other
knows.
Day, by the way. I'm just.
Me too. Was Side there point. Any doubt?
No, not really, but it always makes me happy when BYU loses.
It's cute that they keep calling it a rivalry.
I know. It's really sad, but
it's
anyway.
Like Serena Williams rivalry.
I'm sorry.
Anyone,
that was a side point. Sorry.
No. Yeah. So he went to the University of Utah and we lived in the middle and it worked out nicely.
Oh,
about
great.
Half an hour commute for each of us. And
mm-hmm. That's cool. And so, but then, I mean, you got pregnant right away and you were still trying
we waited forever again, in Utah terms. And
sure.
We waited 9 months after we got married before I got pregnant.
You were an old maid.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought I was being extremely prudent and practical by waiting so long. And I mean, I did, like, we did the math and went, when will I graduate? And when is the earliest that I would want to have a baby after graduating? And it worked and I got pregnant.
Wow.
Immediately upon trying. And so I actually had my oldest son 2 weeks after graduating from college.
Wow. Well,
My senior project.
Okay.
I mean, he was. My senior thesis for women's studies was on the history of childbirth in the uh-huh. U.S. So.
And so you just experienced it firsthand. And
yeah. So it was weird because then I went into childbirth feeling like I was getting graded on this process. And it really did actually kind of mess me up. And I made some stupid decisions.
So,
we're all alive. And fair. I'm here to tell you that however you make a baby that results in both people being alive is a successful childbirth experience.
Absolutely.
Don't beat
That's
yourself
absolutely.
Up.
Very good. So you got done with college and then what happened? Did you get a job in a university right away or what'd you
do? I did not because I had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my husband was still finishing school. He had another year.
Gotcha.
So he finished and then he worked for a while. We had another baby in 2 years, and I was really enjoying being home with them. He went to grad school after 2 years, 2 years after he graduated, and we moved to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And he went to Duke, and we loved it there.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. I love North Carolina. And I had been working as a librarian all through college, and so that was the plan, is that we move there and I'll get a job as a librarian and help, you know, put him through grad school. And we quickly realized that childcare in North Carolina is very expensive, mm-hmm. and librarian salaries are not great. And, I mean, they're not terrible, but they're not great. And that we realized I would make $1 an hour after paying for childcare.
Oh, nice.
So that was stupid. And I decided to stay home because I don't want to make $1 an hour. That's not enough to pay for gas.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I stayed home with them, and our second child had some medical issues that made it really important that, well, it would have made it impossible for me to work anyway, and mm-hmm. Made it important that I was there. But luckily those got resolved. And then he got a job with John Deere and we moved to Iowa, which was not at all on my list of places that I thought I would live. When we got married, I banned only two places, Illinois and Arizona. Illinois, because we had lived there when I was a baby and I had a horrific experience. I mean, now in retrospect, the horrific experience was poverty and student housing as a child, not Illinois. But I blamed Illinois and the weather and the cockroaches, and it was ugh.
Right, right.
And Arizona, because I will never live in a place where there will eventually be a scorpion in my shoe. So,
well, and it's just hot, very hot.
Yeah. Yeah. So he actually got a job in Illinois, but we could live in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
It was 10 minutes away.
Gotcha.
So we lived there for several years, and then we moved to China.
Oh, okay.
Which was, again, you know, all of these things sort of conspire to delay my grad school, mm-hmm. which was fine. You know, I was, if I had wanted it to be a priority, we would have made it a priority. But when people offer you a chance to go move to Beijing for 4 years, you do that.
Right.
So we did that, and it was phenomenal. And I loved everything about it, except the air pollution.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you learn any Mandarin or anything like that while you were over there?
Yeah, I actually got fairly conversational in Mandarin. Mm-hmm. I've lost a lot of it, but
I recall you speaking about that on your podcast just recently. So.
And apologizing for my terrible tones. I've forgotten them all, and they're mm-hmm. very important. But I had a tutor that taught me Chinese, and I'm very lucky that I just pick up languages pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And so Chinese is very difficult. I can't read at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't even bother learning any characters at all because I figured, you know, I can always ask people to read things to me. Mm-hmm. But if I don't understand what they're saying, that won't be helpful.
Right.
So I focused on just learning to understand and speak. And I also asked my teacher, you know, my husband learned proper Mandarin beautiful. He had to give speeches, you know, he's the boss and he has to give speeches in Mandarin. So he speaks beautiful, perfect, you know, tones right on Mandarin. And I was going to be shopping, so I wanted to speak Beijing slang so that I sounded like I lived there.
Okay.
So I asked her, just I specifically said, please teach me slangy Beijing dialect. So she did. So I have an extremely thick Beijing accent in Chinese, which is, I've been told, roughly the equivalent of a very thick Boston accent, in that it's very recognizable, and that people from Beijing think it's the best and everyone else kind of thinks it's terrible.
I gotcha.
So whenever I speak to Chinese speakers now, I mean, it's unusual anyway, because, you know, I'm a white girl with red hair, and you don't expect me to break out Mandarin, slangy Mandarin, but especially not slangy Beijing Mandarin. And so I get big laughs when I speak Chinese because it's quite good slang and also very bizarre.
Fair enough. So you spent the 4 years there in China and then you moved back to the States?
Yeah, we did. We moved back to Iowa, another place in Iowa, and we were there for 3 years and finally decided that we are not Midwesterners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we knew that, but it became very apparent that we are not Midwesterners. And it's beautiful. Iowa is beautiful. The people are wonderful. And the weather is unforgivable.
Mm.
And I just couldn't do it for one more winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we picked up everything and quit our jobs and moved halfway across the country. We made a list of where would we like to live, mm-hmm. and then went on a road trip to all of those places and decided that Boulder was it.
Really?
And just threw everything up in the air and picked up and moved to Boulder and then found our jobs. And
how long ago was that?
That was 4 years ago.
Okay. And what was the attraction for Boulder? Was it the scenery? Was it the climate? The people? What was it?
Yes.
Okay. All of the above.
Yeah. So we knew we wanted to be back west somewhere. Mm-hmm. We missed mountains. Mm-hmm. We missed sort of the outdoor lifestyle that's very different. I mean, there is definitely an outdoor lifestyle in Iowa, but it's very different, right?
Sure, and sure.
Camping in a field is not camping. I'm sorry. Right. There should not be vending machines at camping.
If there are no bears, cougars, you know, then what's the point?
Right. and so we knew that we wanted more of that. And after living in what was a pretty politically conservative area for a long time, we were really feeling the pull back to sort of a more liberal area. Mm-hmm. And so we, on our list, you know, we made this list of places and went everywhere. And we really just tried to sort of, this is funny because it's a very Boulder woo-woo thing, but we just tried to like feel the vibe of the city. It's like, is this our place?
Uh-huh.
Because we actually, so very early on in our marriage, I think right after our oldest son was born, I was reading through some sociology articles because, again, nerd, and found this study that was all about what people in the U.S. think is important for happiness and versus what is actually important for happiness. Mm-hmm. And that if you ask people in the U.S. what is like, what's the key to happiness? What's the most important? All of them will say dream job, find your dream job, mm-hmm. you know, and then everything will, you'll be happy. And that when they did the research, what actually matters, the most important thing is like your primary relationship. You know, if you're in a romantic relationship or that relationship, that's the most important. If that's healthy and good, then that indicates happiness. But the very right below that, the next most important thing is location. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like your house. I mean like where the city, the place where you live, does that match you? Mm-hmm. Is it your place? And then there's a huge gap. And then everything else, dream job, money, health, everything else is way, way down the list after location. And it just stunned me because that's not at all the way we talk about things in this country. And I see it more now, but, you know, 18 years ago, nobody was talking about that.
Right.
And so we talked about it a lot and we said, we need to remember this because, you know, we've been very clear always that we won't do, like my husband said, you know, when he graduated, he said, we have to save up money really quickly so that if I'm ever asked to do something unethical at work, I can quit. You know, we have to have the ability to walk away on ethics grounds for jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those kinds of things were very important to us. I'll never do a job that I find morally objectionable just to make money. And we said, you know, living somewhere that you hate for money is just as bad as, you know, any of these other things, doing those things for money. But we forgot. I mean, we even knew it. We talked about it, but we didn't really live it because I think it sounds silly. That's not it. It can't matter that much. Right. But I am here to tell you now, having lived in the place where we were called our place, it matters so much. So, so, so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are so blissfully happy.
That's good.
In our home. And it's not, you know, it's not like there's a right place to live. There's a right place for you to live.
Right, right.
And you should go find it.
Right, yeah.
You're not a tree. If you can move, move.
That's right. Well, and my wife and I actually, I mean, we want, it's not a thinking about, we are going to probably open up a bed and breakfast hopefully within the next 10 years. Mm. And that's actually why we went on vacation down to Colorado this last time, because we went to Colorado Springs. Actually, this little town at the base of Pike's Peak, and I can't remember the name of it now. Mintu.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful little town. Stayed at a bed and breakfast
that
there.
That whole area is so beautiful.
Yeah. Stayed in one in Colorado Springs, and then we went down to the San Luis Valley and stayed in one down there. And then we stayed in one in Idaho Springs, and then we went to Longmont. Well, we went through Rocky Mountain National Park and did all that kind of fun stuff, but
right.
I think my wife liked Estes Park. I'm not sure who doesn't, but it's just a beautiful place, I think.
I'm going camping there in 2 days.
Are you? Nice. It's a great place. And Longmont was actually kind of a nice little town. I don't know if I'd ever want to live there.
Longmont's beautiful.
Yeah.
But no, it's a cute little farm town.
Yeah. Well, the bed and breakfast
it's not very little anymore,
was amazing.
Actually.
Yeah. It didn't seem like things were very small around. It seemed like everything was pretty much connected.
No, everything's growing so fast.
Yeah. But what we saw of Boulder, we really liked, and we enjoyed, you know, walking down that promenade. And just because there's nothing, you know, in Idaho Falls, Idaho, there's nothing like that. We have the river and we get to walk around the river. I'm not sure if you've ever been through here or around here, but
it's been so long.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been there, but two decades ago.
Yeah, probably went through here to go to Yellowstone or something. That's what pretty much everybody.
I got family in Idaho, but they're all our relatives are in sort of southern Idaho and
like Pocatello area or Twin Falls.
Really middle of nowhere. Oh. Like Whitney, you know.
Oh, Rigby. Yeah, well, Rigby. Yeah,
that's no, Whitney.
Oh, Whitney. I'm sorry.
Well, like population 107.
It must be
small.
This
is where they change the sign when someone has a baby.
Yeah, I've never even heard of it. So it must be very small.
They're tiny.
Gotcha. Well, and Idaho's not a bad place. I mean, we're not like unhappy here.
No, it's beautiful.
But, yeah. But we're just trying to figure out a way to have.
But every place is not for every person.
Right. We're just trying to find a place to have a bed and breakfast. We'd like to have something where it's a seasonal kind of thing. And so we're not maybe operating it all year long. Mm. My wife loves the beach, but I love the mountains. And so we're trying to compromise in that respect and try to figure out exactly how to do it. So we'll figure it out. But anyway.
Well, I'm a big booster for Colorado.
Well, we loved it. I mean, I go down there a lot because, you know, I'm in the potato industry and we have to go down there for potatoes. Mm. But that was the first time my wife had ever been there. And I think she really loved it. So,
yeah, I love it.
We're starting to wrap up, getting close to an hour here. But I do want to talk about your podcast. How did this even come about? What was the you know, can't even think of the word I'm using for here. What started it?
Impetus.
Thank you. What birthed this idea of having a podcast specifically devoted to women that people have, quote unquote, never heard of before?
Yeah. So Katie and I were, when we moved here, finally, I went back to grad school because when we realized we can live anywhere we want, that's when my husband finally said, you should do school like you've always wanted. So that's when I went back to grad school and finished my grad school here. And when I graduated, it's almost impossible to get academic jobs anywhere, and especially around here because everyone in Boulder has a master's degree, and like the person bagging your groceries has a master's degree, and so like I have many years of librarian experience and a master's degree and all these degrees, and I applied for a job to be the assistant book putter awayer at the local library, not even the main book putter awayer, the assistant to the
assistant.
And I didn't even get an interview.
Oh, wow.
So I was terrified that I wasn't going to be able to find a job. And I thought, I cannot. I mean, I'd been working as a freelance writer, a freelance travel writer for years before I went to school. And I, of course, can just do that. But it felt very anticlimactic to finish this graduate degree and do the same job that I was doing before. Mm-hmm. And so I was just desperately trying to figure out something to do that would make me feel like I justified my degree. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, I got great teaching jobs and it was perfect. But so Katie and I had been talking about doing something for quite a while since our fields overlap so well, that we're both very, very interested in women's history. And she, as an undergrad, majored in English and history. So we have very much the same sort of field of interests. And so we were going through lots of different ways to get more women's history out there, writing articles or books or something. And we've long joked that you don't have to be good at something. You just have to be first.
Yeah.
Which I mean, it's not true. You have to be good and first. But if you are first, you have a much bigger foot in the door. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were sort of joking, like, what's the new thing coming? What is the next thing? What's the next blogging?
Right.
And at that point, this is 2 years ago, over 2 years ago, it was very clear, like, podcasting is that thing. This was right when we were on the verge between, now it's what podcasts do you listen to? But at that point, it was right on the hinge between, do you know what a podcast is? Mm-hmm. And do you listen to podcasts? And so we thought, okay, well, if we're going to do it, this is the moment to grab it. because it's in 6 months, it's going to be too big and we're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
So we did. And we decided, all right, sure. Two humanities professors learning to do audio editing. That'll be easy.
Yeah.
Spoilers. It was not easy. but we did it. And we just sat down. And when I was visiting, I think over the 4th of July, we had like an all-day meeting, just brainstorming session of what is this that we're doing? What are we going to do? And we had all kinds of different options of things. Katie's very good at interviewing. She really wanted to do interviews. And I really liked the idea of not having to do a lot of research. I mean, some research, but not as much research as you have to do if you're scripting your own history podcast. And because she did her PhD in England and has this very wide network of sort of famous history scholars because of where she went to school. And I have a similar network of English and women's studies people. And with our family, we have this really wide academic network. And we thought we can resource that and get some great people on really early and maybe actually turn this into something interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think what really clinched it, originally we had just planned that we would alternate episodes. She would do an episode and I would do an episode. It would just be an interview. And then my husband, when we were talking through all of this, he said, you can't do that. People want to listen to Henderson's talking to each other. That's why people come to your house. And, you know, as we were joking about, like, you know, the PowerPoints, the very real PowerPoints at the 4th of July, like, people who like that really like it. And right. We do have people who just sort of come and listen to us talk to each other and find us very entertaining because you never know where the conversation is going to go, but it's always going to be somewhere weird and interesting. And we realize because of that, growing up in that, we're all very good at translating academic things into regular people.
Okay.
And that seemed like a pretty powerful tool to use in a podcast, that we can reach an audience that is in the middle of those. There's, you know, there's the academic world of history and there's very soft pop history, but there's not at that point much in the middle. There is now. There's several fantastic history podcasts occupying that middle space, but at the time there really weren't many doing something that you could use in a college classroom and that your neighbor who never finished high school could enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided, sure, we'll just be all things to all people. That'll be easy. And we're confident.
Yeah.
And let's try to do that. And if we have to talk to each other, okay, then I guess we are the Radio Lab of history, if people listen to that, where it's interview and report. So one of us does an interview and then we talk to each other about that interview. And it's actually turned into a really, really nice format because it allows you to have very low stakes interviews because they know it's going to be cut up. And if they mess up, they can say, oh, I want to redo that.
Right.
But it also gives us a chance to fill in the blanks and have interesting conversations around the stories. So we decided on that, but we still didn't know, okay, what are we doing? What kind of women's history are we doing? And Katie had suggested the idea of doing all the women that are left out. You know, there's all of these women who are just completely fascinating, who you've never heard of. And that's terrible. And I was not sold, frankly, on the idea that people would listen to that. Like, it's already hard enough to sell women's history and a podcast in general. And then trying to sell it, hey, listen to this podcast about people you've never heard of.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to listen to Marie Antoinette, you know.
And, right.
But I was actually walking around in the, there's a great old Pioneer Coal Miner Cemetery up by my campus. And I was wandering around in there because that's what I do, is wander around in cemeteries.
Okay.
I'm the least goth cemetery wanderer that you've ever
seen.
In a pink polka dot dress wandering the cemeteries. And I was just wandering around and I came on this gravestone that just said mother. It didn't have a name. It didn't have any identifying information, just mother and then the dates. And I know that, you know, often these are accompanied by a larger stone that has the family name and all the names. And these are just sort of markers, but everything else was gone. And so all that's left of this woman's life is mother.
Hmm.
And as a mother of three children, I love them dearly, but it was horrifying to me to think of her just being erased and becoming just this role. And it really got me. I mean, I was kind of emotional about it and thinking, this poor woman is disappeared. And I suddenly thought back to what Katie had said just a few days earlier about we've, you know, bring back these women. And I all of a sudden it felt like a mission.
Yeah.
Like, we have to do this. We have to bring these women back. And I called her from the cemetery. All right, that's what we're doing. And that launched it. And luckily it's been, people have been really interested in it. And I think people really enjoy that idea of putting the women back in. You know, it's not, I think some people at the beginning assumed that this would be shoehorning women in, you know, to fill some PC quota or something. We've got to talk about a woman, so go drag somebody out who maybe did something kind of noteworthy. And I think that's why it was so important to both of us, because we both know that that's nonsense, that women were always there. Women were always important and doing amazing things and right in the thick of it. And that it's the story that erases them. They were there. They were doing it. We just need to tell it.
Yeah.
And so it's been really exciting to do that and to bring back a huge variety of women. We have everybody from astronomers to the most brilliant business mind that I've ever encountered, who was a madam in Cripple Creek, Colorado, right there by Colorado Springs, who just was utterly brilliant. Like, she was, I can't believe the stuff that she came up with to market as my business father-in-law said, a very oversaturated market. And she made a distinctive mark. And writers and sculptors and warriors and emperors and just incredible women who did absolutely amazing things, good and bad, and made a huge mark on the world, and then were just poof, disappeared.
Yeah, just gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I've been totally fascinated by your podcast. I've been listening to it for over a year now. And I just, every time it comes on, I just can't wait to listen to it, because they're all fascinating stories. And the way you two converse, is great. I mean, even on a technical level, I think your podcast is fantastic. You do a great job with the editing, and the sound quality is excellent. And like I said, I think one time, I said, y'all should be like an NPR podcast, because it's that quality of a podcast, in my opinion. It's great. So,
and that made our day, because that is the life goal of all Hendersons, is to be on NPR.
That's awesome. No, that's,
we're that level of nerd that, like, that is the peak achievement.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember my brother, who was really, really into baseball, and a fantastic baseball player, speculating about if he could get good enough at baseball and win the World Series, he could probably get on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
That's what he wants to be on, is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
That seemed like the most efficient means to getting on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, was to become really good at baseball and win the World Series.
Well, I mean, NPR, I think, really pushed podcasts into the forefront in a lot of ways, the way they did things, even with their more kind of mild ones like Pop Culture Happy Hour and things like that. They're fantastic. They're well done, and people love them. And then, but then you got people like, what's her name? I can't think of her name. See, that's the thing. Oh, that was a bad pun. I'm sorry. It wasn't intentional.
No, I do it. I do it like 7 times a day. I catch myself, you know, what's her name? Ha!
Right. Oh, she's the famous interviewer, and she's been on forever, on the
Terry
radio.
Gross.
Thank you, Terry Gross. I can't believe I forgot her name. I mean, she's kind of who I idolize after, you know, to try to be that kind of an interviewer, just somebody who is engaging and brings out, you know, interesting things from the people she talks to. And
just, interviewing is hard too. Like,
it's
that
very
was one
hard.
Thing that it's so much harder than you think it. I'm very bad at it.
and it's, I found it even harder. Like, I really love the conversational style that I try to do, but it's very hard to think of the next question or try to make sure you've got the conversation going in the way you want it to get to the end. I don't have any questions in front of me to ask you. It's just what, you know, what sparks me in something that you've said. So it's been a learning curve. It's been fun. I totally enjoyed it. But
I've definitely improved over the year and a half. Katie's a much better interviewer than I am. She's just, that's one of the, you know, she was sort of talking me into it, because, like, I don't know how to do that. And I've gotten much better at it.
Yeah.
But, well, I listened to some of my first interviews, and I've just, those poor people. But that that was why I insisted that we do this format too. Yeah. Of I'm going to cut everything into a million pieces and put it back together so that I sound great.
There you go. That's it. Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize how much goes into the editing process like that. I'll tell you that.
It's so, like 60 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's a few parts I'll edit out of this, like we, you know, some of the comments we made about religion and things like that. So, but okay, so I've started to ask questions at the end of the interview. These are completely random questions. I'm going to ask you two questions since we're kind of running out of time. Are you up for that?
Sure.
Okay, these are questions that I don't even know what they are. I am actually using a random question generator. Okay, so the first one.
All right, now I'm scared.
Okay, well, no, it's mild. They're mellow. I'm not going to ask some strange, like, would you rather questions or anything like that.
Which is your favorite sibling?
Yeah. What's the the velocity of a,
oh, I know that one.
Oh, okay. Which kind?
African or European?
That's right. I don't know. All right. Sorry. What my kids love. I love. All right. Now you got me on that one. Okay.
Sorry. I'm always going to go down the rabbit hole of any pop culture reference that you throw at me.
The rabbit hole. Oh, that's good. Right
that's
there.
That's my brain.
That's another one right from that movie. What fad? Wow, yeah. Here's the question. What right. fad did you never really understand?
Oh, man. So many. I was deeply unpopular as a kid.
Okay.
And I think mostly because I was totally unable to understand most of this stuff. Let's see. Jelly bracelets from my childhood. I don't understand those.
You're going to have to tell me what those are. And
I'm old.
What? Well, I don't know. I have a feeling I'm older than you, but what?
How old are you? How old are you that you don't know what jelly bracelets are?
I am 45 years old.
Oh, see, I'm 41. You have no excuse.
Oh, okay.
They were just like crappy plastic. What were they made? Like silicone.
Oh, okay. I recall
little
those.
Little round
yeah.
plastic bracelets, and you'd wear like 60 of them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember those for sure. Yeah.
I didn't understand those.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of modern fad. I'm so out of it. I don't even know. My kids laugh at me because I'll come up with the fad. You know, I think I've come up with something clever and fun and some new meme to show them. And I show them like, oh, Mom, that was 3 months ago.
Yeah, so 3 months ago. Right. Well, that's a perfect one. We'll deal with that. Jelly bracelets. Okay. Next question and last question. And we'll wrap things up. Okay.
Oh, pink lipstick.
Pink lipstick.
All the whole 90s, like frosted makeup thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not here for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I recall those days. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. Next question. What do you wish your brain was better at doing?
Oh, man. Well, I have pretty severe ADHD. It wasn't diagnosed until I was 39.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And done with graduate school. So that was great timing.
Mm.
And like how much better my brain is on medication at just keeping on task, keeping organized, and like not, I think people think ADHD is getting distracted, but really for me, it's hyper-focus, like the rabbit hole, right? Oh, it's more like squirrel.
Yeah, squirrel, right.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, what species of squirrels? I should look it up. What do squirrels eat? Where did that squirrel come from? I wonder where squirrels, what is the etymology of the word squirrel?
And before you know it, you've spent 6 hours on Google trying to figure out,
exactly. And so being able to rein that in has been really great. So I'm grateful for medications that make my brain more able to do that. I also wish that I know no one can multitask, but I really, deeply, truly cannot multitask to the point that, like, there's a rule in my house that my children are not allowed to talk to me if I'm cooking because I will set things on fire. I can do one thing at a time, and I have actually there was actually a time when I was cooking, stirring something on the stove and talking to my mom on the phone. This isn't not long ago. And it was on fire and I was stirring it and did not notice.
Really?
And my son had to come in, mom, because I was talking to my mom. I can do one thing at a time. Just stirring the flaming pan.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. That would have been really fun to see.
It was hilarious.
Is there any sarcasm in that, what you just said there? I don't know.
A little bit. No, but I mean, I I am so grateful to live in a day of smartphones and alarms. At like how many times my older children were left at school because I went down the rabbit hole and forgot to come pick them up. And now I have about 11 alarms on my phone at any given time. Like, go teach your class. Pick your child up from the dentist.
Wow.
Remember to, you know, like how we all survived without the internet and smartphones. I have no idea.
Yeah. That's a good point. I think I have some ADHD. I would say probably not as bad as yours. But
I thought I was borderline. I mean, that's how I didn't get diagnosed. I'm like, really? It's not bad. I'm just lazy.
Maybe I'm worse than I am. I don't know. I know my wife points it out to me. She's like, squirrel? I'm like, yeah, squirrel. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, then let me just put a shout out to all listeners that if you think that maybe you have something, but you've read, like I had, you know, several of my kids have ADHD and many members of my family of origin have ADHD. And I had read through the screening lots of times and those things didn't apply to me. So I was like, I've got borderline ADHD, but not like, you know, my brother and who is fine with me saying that. and I hadn't realized that the adult screening is entirely different than the kid screening. And once, and so somebody just printed out the adult screening for me, I think is a kind nudge. And I sat and looked at it and just started laughing because every single one of, no, there was one that I thought, well, this, all of them, I was just off the charts, except for one. I said, I never do this. And then they tell you to have the people in your life review your test score with you as well, because you can't see yourself. And so this question was, how often do you not hear when people are talking to you? And I said, that hardly ever happens. And my kids just started laughing and said, Mom, 6 times a day. Uh-huh. And I said, what are you talking about? That never happens. Said, you don't hear us, so you don't know. Oh, is that why you're always waving your hands in front of my face?
Yeah, there goes my dog. Sorry about that. It's fun when you try to record a podcast in your basement.
Yep. So,
yeah. Well, you know what? Now I'm going to have to go down the rabbit hole of finding these adult ADHD tests.
Just go look it over because you never know.
I have a feeling I'm maybe probably more ADHD than I want to admit. Well, Olivia, it has been fantastic talking to you. I thank you so much for volunteering to be on the podcast.
Sure. Thank you. It's been fun.
All right. Thank you so much. And again, everybody go check out What's Her Name podcast. It is phenomenal.
Thank you.
Olivia Michael on Everyone Has a Story. Thank you so much, Olivia, for calling into the dungeon and sharing your story with us. It was greatly appreciated. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that'll find it very fascinating. And thank you so much for doing your podcast. If you guys have not checked out Olivia's podcast, Olivia and her sister, you need to do so. Like I said, it is fantastic. And if you have an interest in women's history, especially those that seem to have been forgotten about over time, kind of washed out of history, it's the best place to find it. They have got some fascinating, fascinating programs. And I highly, highly recommend it. And if you want to share your story here on my podcast, I would love to hear it. Please reach out to me. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me. My Gmail address is knaradio@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me, Instagram, Facebook, all of those fantastic, wonderful social places that you guys all love to hang out. Want to hear you? This podcast does not exist unless we have people like you that are willing to share your story. And I guarantee you, whether you believe it or not, your story is fascinating because you are unique. And you have a story, and we all want to know what that is, okay? So reach out to me. Love to have it. And I hope you guys all have a fantastic week. Thanks again for tuning in here on Everyone Has a Story. I'm Nate Wade, reminding you that everyone is unique. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Have a great week, everyone.